Hey, Tom Tilley here. In a moment on the podcast, we'll take you to Hong Kong, where the protests have taken another very ugly turn. It's great to be back with you in the Hack Studio. For the last 4 days, I've been on the road following the bushfire disaster. I saw the flames. I saw animals trying to escape. The fire is doing amazing work from the ground and the sky. And locals really frightened, working out how to deal with this unfolding, chaotic natural disaster. Although some of them are being investigated as being suspicious. It was intense and very interesting to see it all firsthand.
Hack.
The nightmare scenario we've all been fearing is playing out right in front of my eyes.
Barnaby Joyce argued green policies in New South Wales have had a negative impact.
It's not okay to talk about the climate crisis, but it is okay to talk about people who burned alive in bushfires.
Cooler temperatures are calming conditions in New South Wales today, but the fire threat is set to worsen in Queensland.
On Triple J.
Yeah, big thanks to Avani Dias for filling in the last 2 days. At exactly this time yesterday, I was standing right on the Liberation Trail fire front, just inland from Coffs Harbour, and it was so hectic. I've never seen anything like it before. We were able to go in behind the police roadblock through the smoke, and I literally watched the RFS choppers and ground crews save 2 houses just metres away from where I was standing. Today, on the whole, conditions have eased, which is great news, but there's one fire that's just gone back up to emergency warning level this afternoon near Taree in New South Wales, and there's another one near Noosa on the Sunshine Coast. Tara Cassidy is at the local evacuation centre in Noosa. She's an ABC News reporter. Tara, how close is this fire getting to people's homes?
G'day, Tom. Well, it is getting very close, and that's what's been the main concern for residents and holidays that were over Noosa North Shore this morning. It's really dense bushland over there, and basically there's 180 residents that live over there with either their holiday homes or permanently, and it is, you know, obviously coming within metres of people's houses. So as well as that, there was some people that did actually decide to stay on the island and defend their homes just because of that concern that it was just going to creep very close.
Wow. So have you got choppers water bombing it? You got ground crews in there. What's happening in terms of the firefight?
Yeah, so there has been, luckily for us, water bombers at our disposal. So there's been people, assets in the air and on the ground. We actually had fire crews sent in from New Zealand, 20 firefighters that joined our crews last night. They were flown in. Half of them have been sent to fight the fires that are happening in Gympie near us, and the rest of them have remained on the ground here on the Sunshine Coast, because we actually have 5 fires that are current and smouldering here, including the one at Noosa North Shore. So a lot of people on the ground here trying to get this under control. But I have actually just been told right this moment by authorities that those firefighters have managed to right now get the Noosa North Shore fire under control and within containment lines. It's not out, but it's under control, and they're just going to keep an eye on a possible wind change later tonight.
And had most people evacuated, and are they turning up at that evacuation centre you're at?
So about half. So there are a lot of people that were basically told to get off the island this morning, holidayers, tourists just visiting for the day, as well as the people that live there. Emergency services have tried to get everyone off the island. Some people have gone to the Noosa Leisure Centre, which is the main evacuation centre. Others have gone to family that might live in the area. While, like I mentioned, some have actually decided to go against the orders of authorities and stay on the island to defend their properties.
All right. Thanks, Tara. That's Tara Cassidy, an ABC News reporter, speaking from Noosa, where there's been a fire at emergency warning level. Tara just saying there they have got the fire within containment lines. Very good news. Hopefully that holds. Pretty tense situation there in Queensland. Also just found out a chopper went down fighting fires around the Darling Downs in Queensland, but apparently the pilot is okay, minor injuries. A number of fires there at Watch and Act level, as well as that emergency warning at the Noosa North Shore fire. So far, Queensland has lost around 14 houses in this latest fire emergency. You can get the latest from the Queensland Rural Fire Service website, who are constantly updating. And on radio, if you're in that area, don't listen to me. Get the latest info on ABC Local Sunshine Coast. That's 90.3.
In front of me is a house and the shed is currently on fire.
On Triple J.
At that time yesterday, it looked like the fire could take out dozens of houses. I was speaking to a woman waiting at the bakery in Glenray and she was almost certain that her house had gone up. So did her friend. She felt the same way about her house. They were both living up a valley further in towards the fire. They were standing there anxiously waiting. Turns out most people were spared. I rang the bakery today. I wasn't able to get on to anyone. But an ABC reporter has said that three houses in the Nana Glen, Glenray area have gone. So that's tragic for those three houses, but it could have been a lot worse. Many houses obviously saved by the amazing work from the Rural Fire Services. And they worked from the ground and the sky, very well coordinated. And one house that was saved was Russell Crowe's. He's got a property on the edge of Nana Glen. He lost some structures and the flames came right up to his house, but they didn't take it. So very lucky. Overall across New South Wales, there are 200 homes lost estimated at this stage. 50 of them from yesterday, 150 in the Friday night, Saturday morning fires. So 200 all up, 50 yesterday. One of the houses that burnt down yesterday, last night actually, belonged to a man called Evan Ahern. He has a 25-acre property north of Taree at Upper Lansdowne. And despite how tough the situation is, agreed to talk to us. Evan, thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
I can't believe what you must be feeling right now. The passion you had for this property and to see it destroyed. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, as far as I know, I mean, we weren't there at the time, but as far as I know, the fire was probably 5 or 10 k's west of us. Just sort of came up and down through the gullies and the wind just blew it straight up into our place. And even though the house was designed to be pretty fire resistant, it was steel and concrete and, you know, there were metal fire shutters on the outside of the house and all that sort of stuff, that wasn't enough.
So you weren't there, you were in Sydney, you're hearing all this from your neighbour.
Late last night I was talking to one neighbour who was sort of encouraging and hadn't hit at that stage, so I went to bed feeling, I wouldn't say out of the woods, but, you know, slightly relieved. And then this morning another neighbour rang me who's closer, and he rang me and he said, I'm sorry to tell you, but yeah, the house has been trashed. So
oh, wow.
That sort of burst my bubble.
Oh, that's horrible. Yeah. And how much heart and hard work had you put into that place?
So I would have easily myself planted 10,000 or more trees over the last 15 years. I'd go into the forest and find seed trees and germinate all the seedlings. So the rainforest was coming back, you know, fantastically. And I put an off-grid house on there and it was, you know, it was just paradise.
There's a debate around whether we've done enough backburning or hazard reduction burning of some of those dense forests around people's places in northern New South Wales. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Look, to be honest, that part of the world historically would have been very wet rainforest sort of land. But, I mean, once we cleared it all and burnt the crap out of it over the last 100 years, it's then been dominated by eucalyptus-type plants. And so we've been left with a landscape that is just prone to bushfire. And so even though I come in and I plant lots of rainforest trees and all the rest of it, nobody else is doing that around there. So, you know, under these conditions, yeah, it just goes boom, you know, and rainforest trees don't handle fire, so that's the end of that. So I understand the argument to keep burning, but, I mean, the more you keep burning, all you're left with is stuff that will survive burning, and that's just eucalypts and all that sort of stuff, which wouldn't have been the native vegetation there 300 years ago.
Yeah, it's also complex and there's tricky balances to maintain on many fronts of this debate. Evan, for you personally, when will you be able to go back into your property and what's your plan?
Part of me doesn't want to go back and see, you know, the majesty of what we created burnt to a crisp. I don't want to pick through the remnants of the house with all my stuff. And
yeah.
My kid's death. Pretty hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so anyway, I'll have to do it. I'll have to do it sooner or later. And man up. And but you know, I'm fairly broken. I don't feel like I could do it again. I don't feel like I could put my heart and soul into something like that, to have it just go overnight, you know.
I really feel for you, Evan. I saw how ferocious that fire is, and I also saw how much love and time and soul people put into those properties in the bush. It's a part of them. It's a part of their lives. They spend decades, in some cases, building their little slice of paradise, and then something like this happens.
Well, that's exactly what I did, and it was a part of me, you know. It was always a part of me that I thought I could hand down to my son, and I think a lot of people, you know, put their heart and soul into these sorts of endeavours, and it's heartbreaking to see it happen, and, you know, it's heartbreaking to see governments, I guess, not so much this particular event, but just in general, you know, not really valuing the natural world and putting the economy before the ecology and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Evan, our hearts go out to you, mate. All the best.
Thank you, Tom.
That moment that you go back to the property and decide where to go next. Thanks so much for speaking to us on Triple J.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks again.
Hack on Triple J.
Evan Ahern, and there's the heart of the story, people that put everything into their properties to lose them. On the text line, these fires show climate change is not just a problem for future generations. It's killing people and costing millions now. Now, as you just heard briefly there, there's a debate about controlled burns of forest fuel and how much that can reduce the risk of bushfire emergencies. Even today, billionaire media and mining mogul Kerry Stokes added his voice to the call for more hazard reduction burning. Barnaby Joyce, the Nationals MP, was another voice who's been part of that call. Our next guest is actually an expert on fire management, unlike those two. His name is Greg Mullins. He was the commissioner of the New South Wales Fire and Rescue up until 2 years ago. He's been to California to see how they fight fires there. He's also been calling out the Prime Minister for not addressing climate change as part of his response to the fire disaster, and more importantly, in the preparation for the fire season. As a spokesperson for the Emergency Leaders for Climate Change, he wrote to the Prime Minister asking for a meeting earlier this year to warn him about what has now come to pass. Greg Mullins, great to have you on the show. What are the facts on backburning and fuel reduction? Has there been less of it? And if so, why is that?
Well, look, Tom, across the board, so if a fire can't burn without fuel. Now, I think everybody understands that. So the forest floor, leaves, twigs, shrubs, trees, grass, that's the fuel. And it's a very simple relationship. If there's more fuel, fires can be more intense. So people automatically think, great, we'll remove the fuel. Now, pulling back a bit further, if it's wet, it won't burn. If it's moist and fairly dry, it'll burn, but not intensely. But then on days like we've been having recently, it will burn very intensely. I've seen every time there's a major fire in New South Wales or anywhere in Australia, it's not long before people come out and decide to do a bit of greenie bashing, because it's great to blame somebody, isn't it, for Mother Nature.
Oh, it's great.
Now, Mother Nature is very angry with us because we've almost doubled the amount of CO2 we have in the atmosphere. That's warmed the planet. And what's happening, I'm a volunteer firefighter now, back where I started in 1972. We can't burn like we used to, because it's either too wet or it dries out so quickly that it becomes too dangerous to burn and we can't keep control of our hazard reduction fires. So, yes, hazard reduction's gone down, but there's more to it. People talk about national parks. Their ranks of firefighters and park workers have been reduced hugely over the last 20 years. So you just don't have the people there able to do this vital work. So, yeah, it's part of the mix. But and I'm frustrated that people are saying you can't talk about climate change at a terrible time like this, but we'll speculate about the causes with not much knowledge or information and blame so-called greenies or arsonists or whatever. So let's talk about all of the mix, not just something that somebody chooses their argument.
Yeah, so how you said there has been a reduction of hazard reduction and backburning and fuel reduction, and you explained why, because it's harder to do it and there's less resources to do it, and the reason it's harder to do it is the heating up of the climate. How How big has the reduction of those activities been? Has it dropped off massively or just by a small amount?
Look, Tom, I'm not sure because I'm not privy to those figures anymore. But it varies year to year. Some years there are some windows to burn, other years there's not. You may recall just a few months ago that Sydney was covered in smoke and there was a no-burn order because, frankly, that smoke can kill people with respiratory and cardiac issues. So the changing weather patterns, more inversions that stop the smoke getting out, trap it in the Sydney Basin or anywhere else, the changes in weather over my almost 50 years of fighting fires have been incredible. And sustained changes in weather equals climate change. Now, over the last 20 years, less rainfall, 20% less rainfall in some really fire-prone areas of New South Wales, longer fire seasons, sometimes months longer, many more days of very high fire danger and above, very narrow opportunities for us to conduct hazard reduction. And it all adds up to a pretty frightening picture. And you've heard it, everyone's heard it, the Prime Minister, the Premier, the Fire Commissioners, all saying unprecedented, unprecedented, unprecedented. And the scientists agree. We haven't had wild extreme weather events like this in the past, and it is most certainly able to be proven that it's caused by climate change, and climate change is caused by us burning oil, coal and gas.
Is there still more hazard reduction burning we could be doing despite the challenges presented by the changing climate? Could we still do better on that front?
Look, we could, but unfortunately, and I agree with that, so yes, we could. Would it make much of a difference? Let's unpack that. So I heard today the Commissioner say 1.1 million hectares has been burnt in New South Wales, and I was up in Grafton fighting fires 2 weeks ago. Now, a lot of that is pasture land for livestock. It's grass. You don't burn that off because it's feed for the stock. And if you do burn it, it grows back within a year anyway. So you're back where you started. So there's no point burning that. You had the last person you spoke to, which was really pulled my heartstrings, I've got to say, because I've seen people in that position so often and I don't like seeing it. But rainforest. Not supposed to burn, but it's burning in Queensland, New South Wales, Tasmania, places that have never burned before. You have areas of low fuel where fires have already been, places of high fuel. We were at a fire near Rapville. The fire had gone through 2 weeks earlier and there was a burning stump. The wind came up and the dead leaves that had fallen off the trees that had been killed by the fire, or the leaves had been killed by the fire 2 weeks earlier, that carried flames about half a metre high and they were heading to unburnt country. Mm. So in extreme conditions, you're going to get extreme fire no matter what your fuel loads. So fuel reduction is not on its own the panacea. But And look, the other thing, it's falling to volunteers more and more who have less and less time because of these cuts to forestry, national parks over a long period. So if more resources were put in, they might be able to do more during those narrow windows.
All right, you're listening to Greg Mullins. He's the former Commissioner of New South Wales Fire and Rescue. He was in that job just until 2 years ago. Just before I let you go, Greg, you've been busting a few myths today on the show about the arguments on backburning that pop up around fire time, as well as a discussion about climate change. Barnaby Joyce threw another one out there. He said the sun's magnetic fields were partly to blame. What's going on there?
I won't even dignify that with a response. it needs to read some stuff, that's all.
Actual scientific research, maybe?
Well, that'd be a good start for someone we pay for to represent the nation. Yeah, yeah, represent his electorate. Yeah, it'd be a good start.
All right, Greg, great to hear from you, given your experience fighting fires over that 50 years. Thanks so much for making time for us on Hack.
Yeah, thanks for drawing attention to these critical issues, Tom, and for dealing so compassionately with your previous caller. My heart goes out to Evan and his family.
Yeah, it was really emotional for me to hear that story, having just been on the fire front yesterday. Something about it just kind of kicked for me as well. And you've had plenty of experience doing that. So thank you very much, Greg. On the text line, Jaden from Avoca says, as an environmental scientist and a volunteer firefighter, the drought cannot be understated. It's why we can't burn off in the cool months. Another listener says, Indigenous Australians looked after this country for thousands of years. I've been to the NT and saw firsthand they burn off very regularly. I think we can learn a lot from these original landowners.
Overnight, the anger dividing Hong Kong continued with a violent standoff between students and police at a major university campus.
On Triple J.
Yeah, Hong Kong is starting to look a bit like a war zone, more so than a modern business city. The protest has been clashing with police, and some of the most hectic scenes are at one of the city's busiest universities. There are fires, Molotov cocktails, police in riot gear, smoke everywhere. As Joe Lauder explains, the violence from police and some of the violence from democracy protesters has been shocking.
It's been a hectic couple of days in Hong Kong, and that's saying a lot after 6 months of rolling protests in the city. In this footage, you can see fires light up the night sky. On one side, protesters hide behind makeshift barricades and lob Molotov cocktails at police. And the police are shooting rubber bullets and tear gas at the protesters. The protesters have been ramping up their disruption this week by calling for citywide strikes and blocking buses and train networks. In this video, a policeman on a motorbike is following some protesters as they run off along a blocked-off street, and he leaps back on his motorbike into the protesters once, twice, until he knocks a few of them onto the ground. One of the city's biggest unis, the Chinese University of Hong Kong, has been at the centre of this week's clashes.
People could not get to work, to school. They dare not even to come out on the streets.
Police arrested 287 people on Monday. So in total, more than 3,500 people have been arrested since June. The people arrested on Monday were between 12 and 82 years old, and most of them were students. There have been two people seriously injured as well. A 21-year-old was shot in the stomach with a live bullet by police during a confrontation.
Police are shooting a young student protester in the torso at point-blank range. The video circulating of that was live-streamed on Facebook. It has gone all over the world.
And a middle-aged man was arguing with protesters when he was doused in fuel and set alight. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, condemned the attack.
This is a blatant breach of peace and the rule of law, and is a totally inhumane act that nobody should condone.
These protests started 6 months ago over a bill to extradite people to mainland China to face criminal charges. But it snowballed into something way more significant. It's a fight for a democratic future in Hong Kong and a fight against the Chinese Communist Party's influence. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam appealed for people to stay calm and avoid getting involved in the protests, saying that they're not going to succeed.
If there is still any wishful thinking that by escalating violence, the Hong Kong SAR government will yield to pressure to satisfy the so-called political demands, I'm making this statement clear and loud here. That will not happen. Violence is not going to give us any solution to the problems that Hong Kong is facing.
But a protest spokeswoman told the media that this is all in response to the authorities refusing to listen to their demands.
The point is, the government had ignored and banned all of our peaceful protests. So Hong Kong protesters feel the need to escalate their actions. So the question really should be asking is to the government, when do you feel the need to finally respond to Hong Kong people's demands?
Hack on Triple J.
Is that a reasonable justification for violence from the democracy protesters? Love to hear your views. Send me a text 0439 757 555. That was Joe Lauder reporting. Bill Birtles is the ABC's China correspondent. He's been spending time in Hong Kong. He's on his way there right now. Bill, there's been moments of police brutality all the way along, but the violence from some of the protesters seems to be going up a notch. We've heard reports of protesters throwing corrosive liquids at police, using bow and arrows with flaming arrows. The leaking of personal data of police officers' children. Have those reports been verified? And what other questionable actions have protesters been doing?
Tom, yeah, those reports are generally true. When you're down there, you see it firsthand. Things like protesters will build a barricade into a shopping mall, then they'll cover the floor in some sort of liquid detergent, so if the cops do come in, they all fall over. They're hurling petrol bombs at them. The number one thing that you hear from pro-government supporters down there, but also in mainland China, for example, is if protesters in somewhere like Australia were doing this, how would the Australian police react? Would they allow things to go on as long as they have? And it is a question I ask myself. We're now in the sixth month of this, and the actions in the past few days, frankly, it's been building up to this sort of violence for quite some time. The clashes between the cops and the protesters, yeah, that's been happening since day one. But what we're seeing is street fights and mob brawls and just nasty, nasty clashes between individuals on the streets of Hong Kong.
Are these just the actions of a few dozen outliers who are right on the fringe of the democracy movement, or is this the actions of a greater number of them more at the centre of this movement?
I'd say it's more than a few dozen, probably several hundred. It is still a tiny minority of the total number of people who came out in that first week and held a peaceful march. If you go back to June, remember the first demonstration, there was maybe a million, if you believe the organisers. They said 2 million in the second week. I was there that day. I don't know how many it was, Tom, but it was huge. And so the vast, vast, vast majority of people in Hong Kong originally involved in this movement, they're not part of this violent stuff. They're not the ones doing this. But here's the interesting thing. I was speaking to a few of them this week saying, look, that protest is setting the old bloke on fire. I mean, that is just horrific to watch. But people surely must pause and think, has this all gone too far? And they'll say stuff like, well, yeah, we don't condone that, and we don't support it. But what the police do, what the government does, is worse. And that seems to be a really common attitude still in Hong Kong, which is why the vast majority of people, yeah, they're not doing this. They might not support it, but at the same time, they're so pissed off with the authorities that they kind of turn a bit of a blind eye to it.
Wow. Is that where you think most of those people, you know, the million or 2 million that turned out for those early protests, do you think that's where most of them are sort of sitting right now?
It's hard to say exactly, but I reckon the majority of them still are so angry at police and so angry, particularly at the local government there of Carrie Lam, because she's been coming out every week and saying the same thing basically for 25 straight weeks. They're so angry about that they see all this other violent action and they kind of disregard it a bit. And up here, I'm on a plane at the moment about to head to Hong Kong from Beijing. It's a complete parallel world up in the mainland where everything you hear is about the violence from the protesters towards either mainlanders or towards those who support the government.
Okay, so Bill, you're saying those 1 or 2 million who joined the protest are sort of still siding with the protest because they're so angry with the government, or a lot of them are, but that's only one part of the 7 million overall people that live in Hong Kong. So would most people, the majority of Hong Kongers, want these protests to stop now?
Well, I was speaking to some pro-Beijing people who organised counter-protests just a few weeks ago. Their estimate was 60% of Hong Kong society is pro-protester, 40% is either pro-government or wanting the protests to stop. This is just a rough estimate. But I'm kind of surprised as an outsider every time I'm down there and I talk to people about the violent attacks, and they seem to say, yeah, we don't like that, but this bloody government this and those police that seems to be the prevailing attitude.
Yeah, well, some people like this texter are saying the protesters are becoming terrorists. It is a fine line when you use violence and try and justify that as a means to your end. Bill Birtles, great to speak to you. You better catch that flight.
Thanks, Tom.
Bill Birtles is the ABC's China correspondent.
Hack on Triple J.
That is it for the podcast today. Thanks so much for listening. Loads of people really enjoying our interview with Greg Mullins, the former fire chief. Thank you, thank you, thank you for having Greg Mullins on your show. Finally, someone with experience and knowledge of fire. Yes, there have been a lot of politicians weighing in on things they're not qualified to talk about. I guess in order to suit their own political ends. Thanks for listening. Catch you on the next podcast.